This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Tina Carmelia. Earlier this year, Ng Pavin drove against traffic on the North-South Expressway, crashing into several vehicles, killing one in the process. It later turned out that the teen model had ADHD. She was on prescription medicine to manage her condition. In light of the incident, occupational therapist Teo Joyin shared her views on Facebook and brought up the issue of invisible disability, calling for compassion rather than anger and condemnation. Her post went viral with hundreds of shares, likes and comments. And today she joins us to speak about this topic. Hi. Welcome to the show.
Yes.
Welcome back, Tina. Yeah, it's been a while since we last had you. So before we get into the nitty-gritty, could you give us a summary of the incident?
Well, when this incident first surfaced on Facebook, because that's where I get most of my news from, I didn't really pay much attention to it because as far as I was concerned, there are many such cases of drunk drivers or drivers who are high and on drugs and who get into accidents. So I didn't really pay that much attention to it at first. And when the news surfaced, someone who's very close to me actually sent me a message saying, I knew this girl from primary school and she had already been having mental emotional issues. Now I'm pretty busy. I've been pretty busy, so I didn't really pay much attention to that message. I didn't manage to reply to it. Then further reports surfaced saying that, this girl has an OKU card, that the medicines that she was previously mistaken for taking methamphetamine, but the latest reports showed that she was actually taking amphetamine, which is a related drug to methamphetamine and actually used for the treatment of ADHD. And so, you know, there was more uproar in social media about this fact. Some people were saying, you know, is this a bribery case where the police are suddenly changing their facts? And it wasn't until I started to see more and more really angry comments on social media saying things like, how can a model have a disability? You know, or some people saying, I have worked with OKU, you know, which is disabled people for the last 5 years. And I think people with learning disabilities should not be able to drive. So I don't think she's disabled because she's driving. So this sort of comments made me really, really angry. And rather than get into a Facebook fight with people, I thought, you know, I have my own platform. Why not make a post about it and actually take it as an opportunity to educate people about the circumstances surrounding disability. I mean, it's totally not true that disabled people cannot be models. If you YouTube New York Fashion Week disabled models, you can actually see some really good videos about how disabled people have been modeling on New York Fashion Week.
That's right.
So there's no reason whatsoever that just because she's a model doesn't mean she cannot be disabled. So that post went viral, and there's a lot of positive responses. I think mainly because people on my friend list, having gone to occupational therapy school together with medical students and other health professionals, we actually share similar views. So many people actually spoke up in support. Some people who weren't very clear from non-health related backgrounds, there were other people helping to educate them as well. And through that post going viral, I actually got the chance to meet some people online who were adults who also had disabilities themselves, hidden disabilities themselves. And I was really encouraged by that sort of positive response.
So you wrote a lengthy Facebook post about the incident. Could you summarize that for us and also summarize the gist of the comments that you received? I understand that roughly the comments, as you mentioned, were positive, but there were also a number of comments that weren't very supportive of your arguments. Some of them eventually, saw the light, so to speak.
Yes.
But it was a bit of a process. Would you summarize that?
Yes, because I'm quite used to Facebook uproar, so that's fine. I expected it and I know how to handle it. Yeah. So basically, the gist of the post is to point out that, number one, you can model even if you're disabled. Number two, you can have a learning disability and still drive. I have a friend who's a clinical psychologist. He is diagnosed with dyslexia and he drives. I have a friend in the US, occupational therapist, diagnosed with autism. He drives. And on that same post, a friend from the UK, occupational therapist as well, says she has ADHD. She takes her meds and she drives. So there's no reason whatsoever for people with learning disabilities not to drive. And there were, of course, many responses on that post saying that, you know, it should not be an excuse. And I totally agree that just because this girl has a disability doesn't mean that, you know, she should not be responsible for her actions. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, drinking and driving is wrong. And she definitely drove while drinking. But to pinpoint it down, to say that this accident happened because of the disability itself, I would say it's wrong. And to perpetuate stereotypical and stigmatizing views of people with disabilities is wrong as well. So I think, you know, it is important to exercise compassion in this case. I think the girl herself, I mean, having gone through primary school years without being diagnosed, even though her issues were obvious enough, you know, for people around her to pick up, and perhaps even lacking the kind of support that she needed, you know. So it's very hard to say why is it, how is it, but she definitely knows that she should not be drinking while driving. I would say that's for sure.
Could you give us an insight into why the initial reports mentioned that she was on meth?
Yeah.
Is it because it's very similar to the ADHD drugs?
Yes. Amphetamine is the ADHD drug. Meth amphetamine is the drug used for recreational. Yeah. So they are very similar, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, amphetamine was mistaken for methamphetamine. I would actually suggest people put in some effort to Google and read up more about the similarities. Amphetamine is definitely an ADHD drug, among many others. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And was she misusing her prescription drug, or that had nothing to do with the case?
I cannot say for sure because mm-hmm. I'm not her therapist and I never had the chance to talk to her. But I would say that, well, if you're drinking and you know you're on prescription drugs, could there be a chance that there could be a reaction? Because the news reports say she was hallucinating. Maybe. So I think it's more about, well, I don't even know how aware she is of how she should be taking her medicines, mm-hmm. you know, or is she aware and not compliant, for instance? These are very grey areas that definitely need to be looked into further. Yeah.
Now, I want to come back to the term invisible disabilities. We've been using that a little bit. But if you could define what we mean when we say invisible disability, how would you define it?
Well, in order to understand invisible disabilities, I think first we need to understand what disabilities are. And there are medical definitions of disability as well as legal definitions of disability. Now, the legal definition of disability is differs from country to country. And here in Malaysia, conditions like ADHD and autism and Down syndrome are classified as learning disabilities under the legal disability definition. I do not necessarily agree that they should be classified as learning disabilities, but they are classified as such. So the way I see it, when I'm trying to explain disability to people, to the general public, for instance, I would say, okay, for instance, you are transplanted into a country where nobody speaks any language you speak. For instance, if you put me in Myanmar, people don't speak English there that much, and there are no languages I speak which the Myanmarese people would be able to understand. So I would be disabled because the circumstances would not allow me to function to my full ability. Yes, I can still bathe, I can still function in a sense, I can look for food to eat, I'm still alive, but it doesn't mean that I can perform and participate fully in life, you know, because that's a language disability there. So invisible disabilities are similar in that sense, you know. The people can function, they can drive, they can go to work, but it doesn't mean that they are functioning at their best, yeah, and able to participate fully in life.
And why is it important that people are made aware of this distinction? that it is an invisible disability?
Well, invisible disability just means that, like I said, you can't see it. So a lot of times when interacting with people, sometimes we might not be in the right state of mind to exercise compassion when interacting with them, especially with the kind of social media interaction we have these days. People are very volatile, and it is easier to be angry and be a victim than to think, okay, you know, could there be a reason? Could there be a reason why this person is behaving this certain way? Could there be a reason why this person is not able to do what they're doing? And I think in Malaysia, we actually have many people walking around with undiagnosed invisible disabilities, and many people are getting frustrated with them, but we don't really know why. So being aware that invisible disabilities exist would at least bring us one step closer to solving, you know, some of the issues that crop up when interacting with such people.
Is it accurate to say that all learning disabilities are invisible disabilities? Would that be a fair statement?
Not necessarily, because, according to JKM, Down syndrome is classified as a learning disability, but it's very visible.
Yeah, it's probably one of the most recognizable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see what you mean there. Okay.
Yeah.
But what are the common misconceptions when it comes to invisible disabilities?
Well, some people think that invisible disabilities means learning disabilities, not necessarily so. It can be physical. I have clients with chronic pain. And if you look at the JKM definitions for physical disability, it also mentions cardiorespiratory issues. So, for instance, people with, let's say, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, they are disabled because they constantly experience shortness of breath, fatigue. They're not able to perform many of their everyday activities. And so this causes them to be disabled, but it's not visible. It's not something that's visible. And depression, for instance, mental, classified as a mental condition. This is also an invisible disability. And sometimes people who are experiencing the condition might not necessarily be aware of it. For instance, after the issue was highlighted, I did a series of on invisible disabilities on my Facebook group. And then somebody contacted me through Facebook, a friend, and then he said, oh, you know, I think I might have an invisible disability. This is what I'm experiencing. And then I said, okay, you know, here are a few more articles. This person's in Indonesia. So here are a few more articles and videos and resources. You go through them. And then he said, yeah, I think I actually have this. You know, what can I do to get help? So he's actively taking action. So it's good to see that sort of response coming on, because, like I said, a lot of people don't know about invisible disabilities. Sometimes we don't even know we're having an invisible disability ourselves.
All right, I'm speaking with Teo Joyin, an occupational therapist, about invisible disability. Coming up, we will be addressing some of the questions raised by netizens, including whether people with invisible disabilities should be allowed to drive, hold a job, or be in public spaces at all. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, I'm Tina Camellia, and you're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. Occupational therapist Teo Joyin joins me today to discuss invisible disability, a topic that became big recently after a teen drove against traffic, causing a massive traffic jam and the death of a driver. She claimed to have made a U-turn after seeing a stalled lorry. It was later discovered that she might have been hallucinating under the influence of drugs. The drug she was taking, first said to be meth, was to treat her ADHD. There were also some reports saying that she was drinking and driving. Interestingly, she was also a card-carrying person with disability due to her ADHD. Now, earlier we were talking about defining invisible disabilities and why is it important for us to be aware of it, and also some of the misconceptions surrounding invisible disabilities. I want to know how you, as an occupational therapist, fit into the picture when we're talking about dealing with disability in general, but also invisible disability.
Well, yeah, traditionally, occupational therapists have always worked with disability. And what occupational therapists are supposed to do is to help people engage in their everyday lives, you know, as fully as we can. So we play many roles as far as enhancing participation is concerned. For instance, in terms of this particular case, you know, I think an occupational therapist could definitely play a huge role in medical management. We ensure that our clients, you know, are able to keep their medicines organized and they are able to fit into their routine. And for instance, if there are side effects to the medication, whether or not the activities they're, whether how it's going to impact the activities they're participating in, how to adjust accordingly. In this situation, as far as people with disabilities driving is concerned, occupational therapists abroad actively conduct driving assessments to ensure that disabled people are able to drive safely and, you know, recommend modifications, for instance, so that they would be able to still stay engaged and, you know, access is easy for them. And for instance, we would actually teach people with ADHD for, how to manage their condition, how to recognize when certain patterns. For instance, a lot of people with ADHD have sensory processing issues. They cannot sit still. It's not because they cannot sit still and they cannot pay attention. It's not because of because they want to be that way, but it's because they're neurologically wired to be that way. Their brains are telling them to behave that way. So what kind of exercises can they participate in to help their brains calm down, for instance? So in terms of what occupational therapists can do for people with disabilities, it depends on a case-by-case basis what the person's needs are, and then we will work together with them because they are the experts of their lives. They are the experts of what they're going through. We will not be able to tell them what they're experiencing, but they can tell us what they're experiencing, what their difficulties are, and we can work together with them to try to find solutions.
And earlier you were mentioning about how you assisted someone in Indonesia to recognize these signs to seek further help.
Yep.
But not everyone has that sort of access to someone who is knowledgeable to recognize these signs. And also you would need to be medically diagnosed for you to get further help, for you to have access to getting an OKU card, for example, for you to get access to an occupational therapist and attend therapy, for example. To have a proper diagnosis is quite important. How do you encourage someone to make that first step?
Well, occupational therapists don't have to work with people with diagnosis. I have worked with several people who do not have diagnosis, but it's very clear, or rather, you know, they know they have certain issues that they need help with. And I think in this day and age, more and more health professionals are becoming more accessible via social media platforms. For instance, I have my Facebook group, AskJY, bracket occupational therapist, which is... we've got about 1,000 people in there and they follow my posts and then it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I've got something, I need some help. So, I mean, I'm not practicing anymore. I'm a lecturer in a university. So I would refer them to the appropriate sources. And that's what I really, that is one good thing about the laws in Malaysia. It doesn't require you to get a formal diagnosis in order to access occupational therapy or other therapeutic support services. But to get an OKU card, you definitely would need to get a formal diagnosis. And details are actually quite easily available through Google. You know, if you look on the JKM website, you Google how to obtain an OKU card in Malaysia, you would be able to get the details.
Who is at risk of getting invisible disabilities and what are the impacts?
So as far as invisible disabilities are concerned, I mean, right now I'm lecturing in a college and I, after doing so, I started to realize that a lot of college students actually have invisible disabilities and they don't realize it. The lecturers don't realize it. And the lecturers think it's just the students being insolent and misbehaving, you know, or lazy. And so what I have found... And I would encourage everybody here to go look up this YouTube video, Neuroscience of Poverty, because this is something that I have constantly brought up, even to the university authorities. And at first, you know, they couldn't quite understand it, right? But people from working class backgrounds, people from impoverished backgrounds, would also have a higher tendency towards developing cognitive-related disabilities in terms of thinking and judgment, and also sensory learning-related disabilities, because as children, children need to be to receive enough nutrition while growing up, and also the right sensory stimulus while growing up, to be able to develop properly. So sometimes the children might not necessarily be born with the disability, but it could be acquired, you know, in the process of growing up, because the child didn't receive the exposures they needed, you know, or the nutrition they needed. So I would say that people from working class families definitely have a higher tendency towards acquiring these disabilities as they grow up, as well as urban children who are cooped up at home without much stimulus, without much exposure to different sensory input, for instance. You know, so this would actually sometimes we do notice some people say, oh, you know, my child is cured of this certain thing after doing this sort of exercises, for example. But it's mainly because the child has actually acquired the neural pathways necessary to help them develop properly. So I would really encourage parents to pay attention to this, you know, take your kids out more, make sure they get the right nutrition. But in the case of working class families, it's very difficult when the parents are not educated themselves and they do not know where to get the support they need.
And what can we do to help them?
I'm still trying to.
I suppose it has to come perhaps through the schools or a different system outside of the household.
Yes. Sometimes the parents do not have a coping mechanism themselves.
Yeah.
And my students, you know, they're from working class families. And when they realize that they have family members who had disability, is one of them. So she went to tell the parents, look, you have to take your child for assessment and things like that. And the parents were like, no lah, you know, or some people think it's a magic effect of a magical spell, for instance. So it is very difficult, and outside intervention and support is definitely needed in these cases. So again, the best what we can do, you know, as the general public, is to look out for each other and actually pay attention to these populations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, goes back to paying attention to these marginalized populations and ensuring that it's not just about us getting the best life we can, by ensuring the people around us, you know, will be able to live the best life we can and get access to the best support that we can give them.
Yeah, we're all in this together.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, just to be clear, when people go for therapy for their condition, whether it's a learning disability or other forms of help that they, where they require sessions with an occupational therapist, in this particular case, at least when it comes to learning disability, it's not necessarily to look for a cure, but rather to help them with going through their day-to-day life.
That's right. Yep. And for instance, in the case of social interaction, which some, like for instance, autistic people, they have a lot of difficulties with social interaction. So we would actually help them smoothen. You know, sometimes for me, for instance, sometimes I need to work with the family members, not just for people whose conditions cause them to have social interaction issues. Generally, most of the time when people are diagnosed with some sort of condition, whether it's stroke or whether it's, for instance, Parkinson's, there is a lot of conflict and disharmony within the family. So sometimes I need to work together with the whole family to be able to generate a solution for them.
Right.
Yeah.
Are parents misdiagnosing their children when it comes to learning disability? Do you think that is the case?
That is very subjective, because it depends on, I mean, speaking in a Malaysian context, depends on where the parents are coming from. In the rural areas, a lot of parents are not, or in the less developed areas, I'm not sure if you would say Penang and Butterworth is rural, there's not a lot of awareness on disabilities, so the children are generally undiagnosed. Or sometimes the school authorities might bring up to the parents that, okay, you might need to take your child to get checked. You know, we think there's something that's not quite right. But the parents might be reluctant to. They just think, oh, my child is stupid, my child's lazy, you know, just need to beat them some more, and then they will perk up. No, they won't. If they have, you know, this sort of condition stopping them, they won't. And in the more middle class areas, Klang Valley, sometimes we have a lot of parents who are very worried for their children. So I would say it depends, whether or not parents are actually meet that. Sometimes the parents are very worried about their children, and then I see them, and then it's like, oh, okay, I don't think your child's issues are that serious. You just need to take them outside more, play. And you might need to monitor certain things for a certain period of time before we can actually say whether or not your child has this sort of a disability.
So it's clear that it's really important to identify learning disabilities as early as possible so that they can definitely get the assistance they need. And I know that this may be too general, but if you could give some pointers about what to look out for to continue monitoring, at least in the household setting, before you decide, okay, maybe my child needs to be checked. What are the signs to look out for when it comes to learning disabilities?
Yeah, so one of the very common questions I find myself asking parents is, do you think your child is doing this on purpose, or do you think your child can't help it? And I think that's very important. Only the parent at home would be able to tell, because sometimes if you take the child for assessment in a center, the child's going to behave in a totally different way.
Oh, that's right.
I also encourage parents to take their child to difference. If they sometimes, yeah, parents are they have legitimate observations that their child's not functioning very well in a certain environment. So I say, is this issue repeating itself in other environments? You know, because I had one situation where there was a parent who, well, actually the parent was coming to me as a client. Then she had some issues with her child in school. And then she says, oh, the school thinks my child has a learning disability. And the school says my child is doing this in school. Is wandering around, is walking on tiptoes, and is showing signs of developmental disability. But when the child is at home, the child doesn't show these features. So what's wrong? So I said, you know, in that case, you might need to check whether there's something in the school environment that's stressing the child out to cause the child to behave in this way. Because sometimes, I mean, we have tics, we have fidgets, you know, this is just our body trying to regulate its senses. So it could be just a response to stress. Yeah.
And similarly, because children spend a lot of time in schools, do you think that there is enough awareness within the school settings to recognize learning disabilities and to take proactive actions?
This is very hard to say. Again, it depends on which part of Malaysia we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Although I do notice that, I mean, I have had schools, government schools actually contact me to say, you know, can you do something for our school and educate our teachers more about how to work with disabled children, because we don't know. So I think it's really good. The awareness is increasing. The fact that people are actually asking me, you know, these sort of questions, but how much they actually know, how much are they actually able to apply, perhaps there's a lot more that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you mentioned that it's not that difficult to get information about how to get yourself an OKU card. But attitudes might change when you say, I have an OKU card, or I'm legally recognized as a person with disability. What do you have to say about the stigma surrounding invisible disabilities in particular? I think we're more empathetic when we see someone who's physically struggling, like someone who's blind or someone who's in a wheelchair. But when you say it's a mental health condition, for example, or a learning disability, it's still, the stigma is still so present.
Well, I did, when I made that post on Facebook, one of my colleagues in the UK actually revealed that she had ADHD, and she said, I don't talk about it too much. I don't tell anybody because it's just too much work to go and explain it to them. I totally agree. And sometimes, you know, it's not just the general public, but sometimes even within the medical professions, we perpetuate this sort of stigma as well. I mean, I have some form of indisability myself. It's not diagnosed, but I know I definitely have a chronic condition that's affecting the nerves in my arms. For instance, I respond quite badly to cold. And so when it's cold, my fingers freeze up and I can't do things like writing and typing and stuff like that. I have to protect myself and keep myself warm. And if I'm not careful, it can actually affect my driving. And I remember when I was studying, because to do orthopedic occupational therapy, which is hand therapy or with bone-related conditions, we need to do something called splinting, where we mold thermoplastic splints with our hands. And this is very laborious, and my hands were just not fit to do it. If I start cutting a thermoplastic splint, for instance, my hands will start to shake and, you know, start to become numb or start to be in pain. So I've had lecturers who said things like, if you're not able to splint, then, you know, you're not an occupational therapist. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I can't function as one. I can't practice as an occupational therapist. But fortunately, I learned from occupational therapists abroad that it's not necessarily true. Splinting is not a core skill in occupational therapy, and you don't have to be able to splint to be an occupational therapist. So that helped me be a bit more secure in my professional identity. And I think that's certainly the case, you know, with other invisible disabilities as well. Sometimes we are not aware of what we are perpetrating when we make statements like this, which one would call ableist statements. So I think it's just more education, and the public just has to make a more deliberate effort to listen to people with disabilities. I mean, the disability rights movement has a slogan, nothing about us without us, which is something that I hope I constantly have to remind myself of whenever I work with my clients. Do not make decisions about them without their input. So for this particular case, for instance, of the girl with ADHD driving, there was a lot of people making all sorts of comments about disabled people, and the disabled people do not necessarily have that voice or that platform to be able to respond. It's a two-way conversation. I mean, yes, we understand why you're angry, but also at the same time, just be prepared to listen as well.
Now, let's talk about the role of social media. Mm. It's a double-edged sword. Mm. For example, you know, on the one hand, like you mentioned, how you can easily go online and look up New York Fashion Week and you see people with disabilities running, walking down the, or I mean, wheeling down the runways. Mm. You'd see people with Crohn's disease, for example, showing off their colostomy bag. Mm. But on the flip side, you have, in this case, people going all out bashing this poor teen without really caring about her backstory and her condition. What are your thoughts on social media as a tool for raising awareness when it comes to disability in general?
I think it's a very good thing. You know, despite angry people online and all that, I still think it's good outweighs the bad. So it's more knowing how to navigate those interactions. I expect that the bad stuff is going to come, and then how we're going to deal with it. that's the most important part. So for disability activists out there, you know, don't allow voices to silence you. Don't allow angry voices to silence you. I think that's very important.
And as someone who works with people with disabilities, how do you think Malaysia is doing? What's your assessment as a country? How are we doing in terms of the way we deal with invisible disabilities?
I think that there is growing awareness, and I actually have a very positive feeling about it. You know, well, the more publicity that disability gets, the more opportunities it creates for disability activists to be able to speak up and educate. So I think we're definitely moving in the right direction. You know, there's a lot of awareness. There's a lot of people contacting me and saying, you know, oh, what can we do? What can we do? It's sometimes it feels like I actually have more work than I can handle because there's so many requests going on. And that's also why I'm on this, because it's here to help me save time.
Very good. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think Malaysia is moving in a good direction as far as recognition of disability is concerned.
So how can we, the regular folks, how can we help make the lives of these people better, easier, help them integrate with the society?
Well, In the case of invisible disabilities, we will never know that the person is disabled. And I think it's more on reflecting on ourselves and exercising compassion for people in general, regardless of whether or not we know the person is disabled. We don't have to wait for the person to disclose that they are disabled to be kind to them. We should just be kind to human beings in general. And to create more inclusive environments for people, take the effort to understand and marginalized groups, not just disabled people, but also other marginalized groups, because they're all interrelated. Yeah, basically that is the focus, you know, on inclusion and kindness and compassion. I think that's what society needs more of these days. There's recently been a case gone viral on Facebook where this woman was sitting next to, I've posted it on my Facebook group, this woman sitting on a plane and she accidentally touched the woman next to her with a bag.
Yes, I read about that too.
And then the woman next to her started to hit the lady with the bag's child. Well, this lady in this situation took the time to stop and think and exercise compassion in this case. And it eventually turns out that the angry woman who hit her child actually has some form of mental illness.
Bipolar, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. So this is one instance which shows how the general public could react, you know, when something is not quite right. For instance, we just take a step back and say, oh, okay, what is this? This is not normal. Is the person doing it on purpose, or is the person can't help it? Yeah.
Now, we've reached the end of our show. If there's any final message you would like to put out there?
I think it's very important. Again, I can't stop to emphasize how important it is for us to be aware and to learn as much as we can on how to make the world a better place for everybody. Yeah. And if somebody is offending you, try to check whether they're doing it on purpose or not. Mm-hmm. Most often of the time, they're not. They might be having an invisible disability and might not actually be aware of it. So being mindful and compassionate is definitely very important. And stay educated. Learn as much as you can. Join my Facebook group, Ask JY. If you want to stay updated, you know, on more interesting articles about disability.
All right, that's wonderful. That was occupational therapist Teo Joyin discussing invisible disability. If you missed any part of the interview, you can download the podcast from our BFM app available on the App Store and Google Play. I'm Tina Camellia, and you've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.